Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom, Sabbath greetings to everyone. As I said, we started a little bit later. We kind of got caught up in a sort of family reunion here. You know, it's Mother's Day season, so bear with us. But we're all on track now, and thanks to everybody who's already on board listening. Thank you for your patience. As you can hear, perhaps there's a kind of a wild crowd here today, but we'll try to keep them under control as best we can. We've got all ages, young and old. I was going to say rich and poor, but I don't know who the rich ones are. But it reminds me of a story about an accountant, or actually about a businessman. A businessman was talking to another businessman, and they were having a conversation about how things were going. And one said, "We're looking for a new accountant." So the other one said, "But I thought you just hired one recently." And he said, "Yeah, that's the guy we're looking for."
No.
But that's the way it seems to be going these days, you know, in business. Every time I read the news, it's some other scandal, unfortunately. So on a more positive note, there are mothers in this room now where I'm speaking. There are mothers here, and there are mothers out there listening. So, you can hear the evidence, that we have mothers here. So to those of you who are out there and in here, and to those who listen later, happy Mother's Day. And if you hear this after Mother's Day, we hope you had a happy Mother's Day. Have a happy Mother's Day next year. You know, all the best to you. And because this is Mother's Day, we might want to consider our spiritual mother, the church, and our roots, as it were. The times of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. I want to go back today to Abrahamic times, and I want to make a few points as a result. So I'll call this talk in a very loose way, some lessons from Genesis, which is a very loose way to comment on this, but I suppose it might attract listeners later, because they may think I'm going to be talking about dinosaurs or who knows what, but that's not what I'm going to be getting into. I'm going to call this some lessons from Genesis. So the passage I'm going to read is a coherent passage. The lessons are not necessarily coherent in terms of all around one point, but various lessons we can learn from the passage in Genesis I'm going to go into. And as I said, it's going to be a passage of from patriarchal times, from the times of the patriarchs and the matriarchs, from Abrahamic times. And I want to begin by reminding us that the Bible, there's a reason why we have the Bible. There is a reason why we have the canon. And it's important for a person to examine the concept of canon. Just what is the Bible? Just what verses are authoritative, you know? What collection of verses, what collection of scripture, you know, is authoritative? There are groups that want to add their own, holy books. We have in America, a very popular religion, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. No, it isn't LSD, it's LDS. If you saw the old Star Trek movie, I know right now we're in the age of the new Star Trek movie. Back in the old Star Trek movie, Captain Kirk goes back to the 60s and he tells somebody, "My friend got involved with LDS." "Oh, really?" You know. But anyway, the LDS Church, as you know, has their own extra collection of scriptures. Then we had the Muslim religion, which has the Quran. You know, so once we've made the decision, though, that there is a Bible, that God has inspired a collection of material, then we need to dig in and study it and realize that it needs to be put together, that one part will shed light on the other part, and that we have to realize we are inadequate if we don't have all of it. It doesn't mean you can't be have a right relationship with God. It doesn't mean that people 2,000 years ago who didn't have all that we have, you know, couldn't be righteous people. But we have the complete collection, and we need to be grateful for that and take advantage of it and not necessarily shoot from the hip, or maybe better said, shoot from the lip. You know, we ought to be careful before we draw a conclusion to put all the data together and have respect for the material and realize that there is a canon and realize that material was given in a context. In other words, if you read, for example, the book of Genesis, there are things said in Genesis that wouldn't make sense unless you knew more than what's there. Things are mentioned that people knew about then, that we, you know, if you're just picking up the Bible and never saw it before, and you start in Genesis, you're going to read about things you don't know about unless you know the rest of the Bible. So there's a certain background assumed. And if you don't have that background, you better keep reading and get that background, because by the time you finish the entire 66 books as they're organized in your translation, you will have sufficient background to get the essence of the message. So I think that's very important. And you'll see that today. I want to talk about Abraham and Sarah, the founders of our community, physically in some cases, spiritually in all cases. Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham, as you know, was the father of all those who believe. And I want to say something about that. I want to go to Romans. First of all, the book that Paul wrote, the letter that Paul wrote to the church at Rome, which was both Jewish and Gentile. And Rome was the capital of the Roman Empire of that day. So it was, where, you know, very, very critically important city. Paul was there and established a church there, wrote to it later. And in Romans 4, he talks about the importance of faith and that none of us is really, quote unquote, good enough to have eternal life. You know, that's a gift that God gives. It's not something that we earn. And he went into that at great length, at great depth in the book of Romans. And in Romans 4, verse 11, he talks about Abraham, how he was circumcised. And he in verse 11, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while still uncircumcised. See, God called him when he was uncircumcised. Now, later on, he gave him that sign, but when he called him, he was physically uncircumcised. So circumcision has its role to play, but it isn't, of course, critical to salvation, obviously. And he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of faith which he had while still uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all those who believe, though they are uncircumcised. You know, whether or not, you know, Israelite, Gentile, whatever their background, racially, nationally, they're going to be saved through Jesus Christ, and it's not a matter of the physical. He might be the father of all those who believe, that he might have that opportunity. Obviously, it depends on the person's acceptance of God's plan and his willingness to live accordingly. The father of all those who believe, though they are uncircumcised, that righteousness might be imputed to them also. In other words, they would have that righteousness that comes because we've accepted Christ, because we're not going to be on our own ever going to be perfect, but we can be salvageable, you might say, savable, if you want to put it that way, through Christ. Verse 16. Therefore, it is of faith that it might be according to grace. In other words, we're saved by God's love, and we haven't earned it, so that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law. It's not only to the Israelites who had the written code, the Torah, but even to those Gentiles who never had that background, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. So if you go to the book of Galatians, another church that Paul, to whom Paul wrote, this was a largely Gentile church, Greek-speaking, in what is today Turkey, but in those days it was Asia Minor, it was a Greek, culturally a Greek area. The Galatians were not necessarily Greek ethnically, but they were Greek-speaking. They may have even been, these people may have even been Greek ethnically, for that matter, the ones that Paul wrote to were very, possibly even Greek ethnically. And in chapter 3 of Galatians, verse 29, he says, "And if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's seed." So if you're a Christian, you become, spiritually speaking, a spiritual Jew, a brother or sister of Jesus Christ, who is a descendant of David, and then you inherit the promises given to Abraham with all that that implies. "And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise." So Abraham is the father of the faithful. And Abraham is the father of three great religions that have had an influence on the world in terms of getting the world exposed to God's way of life and to the reality of the one God. Now, obviously, all these three religions have become distorted in a way, or have distorted the message. But nevertheless, they have had their role to play in spreading ethics and morals, and in spreading a knowledge of the history of God's dealings with people and a history of the knowledge of the true God. These are the three Abrahamic religions, the three monotheistic faiths, and we need to respect that. You know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. We need to have a certain respect for that reality. And one way that people demonize other religions is by saying, well, we worship God and whatever, and they worship, you know, whatever. You know, they don't really worship God, we do. And so then you can kind of discount those people and you lose some respect for them. Now that is an overstatement, and it really isn't appropriate. Now it is true that if you look at Islam, let's first take Christianity because we're more familiar with it. We live in a supposedly Christian civilization, although it's less and less becoming that. It's more and more becoming Greco-Roman, like the civilization of the first century that Paul had to deal with. But in a certain way, this is a Judeo-Christian civilization, that of the Western world. But if you look at mainstream Christianity, who were the Christians before they became Christians? They were largely sun worshippers, many of them. And so they brought that baggage with them. We all bring baggage into our relationship with God that came from our past that we have to deal with. And the Christianity in mass, the people that came into that religion had been sun worshippers. So it makes sense that their day of worship is Sunday, and that they also have a day when they celebrate the birth of the sun, the winter solstice and the beginning of light, you know, where light begins to increase again. The old Saturnalia festival, which is now called Christmas, and you know they have this baggage that they have brought with them. On the other hand, you know the Muslim world was a world where the sun didn't matter that much because the culture of the Muslims is heavily influenced by the Bedouin life, and the Bedouins were not a people who necessarily settled in cities and cultivated land. They were wandering people in the desert. So obviously the sun in that sense is your enemy. When you're not a farmer or you're not a city dweller, when you're roaming around in the desert, you know, actually you prefer the cool evenings and then the light of the moon and the stars is what you're looking for. And so the people of that region, they were very much interested in moon worship, which is also connected with the worship of Venus. And as you know, Venus's day is Friday. And so their day of worship is Friday. And their symbol is not a cross, which is related, if you look at the ancient Egyptian Ankh symbol, it has an oval with a cross under it, which was related to sun worship. Their symbol is not the cross of mainstream Christianity, but the crescent moon, and often with a star there, you know, so they have that symbol. Now, that does not mean that modern Christians are worshiping a pagan god or Muslims are worshiping a pagan god. It means they brought baggage with them when they came, and so the baggage is there. But, you know, let's say that there's somebody living in Tampa, all right? I'm here in Kissimmee, and somebody's living in Tampa, and I know him really well. Well, maybe I know him better than you do. Let's call him, I don't know, call him John Smith and say he lives in Tampa. I might tell you all about John Smith, and you might say, oh, yeah, I know John Smith, and you may know some things about John Smith that I know, but you may also have a little bit of a distorted view of John Smith. Does that mean that you're talking about another person? No, you just don't have as intimate knowledge of John Smith as you should. Some of the things you know about him are inaccurate. You're still talking about John Smith. You know, it's the same thing here. You know, Muslims and Christians are worshiping the same God as we are. Now they may deny that if they want to get vicious with each other, but that's the case. These are three monotheistic religions, and they're worshiping the same God. But I would have to say that Muslims, Christians, and Jews, for the most part, are worshiping a distorted image of that God, or have a distorted view of that God. That's my view. If I didn't have that view, I wouldn't be sitting here doing this. I'd be joining them. You know. So obviously, I feel we have a more accurate view in this room than they have. You know, that's just what I believe. You know. But I don't. But I'm not saying we're worshiping a different God. And so I hope that we don't use that kind of language in this community when we talk about Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Not that we agree with them 100%, but let's not demonize other people, other religions in that way. Anyway, we're talking today about Abraham, and I'm showing you the importance of putting the whole Bible together, putting the scriptures together. And so I want to go to Acts 7. Because in Acts 7, we're hearing about the history of Abraham, but we're hearing it in the New Testament, and so it's adding a bit to our understanding. We're clarifying things. The Old Testament leaves some things questionable, unclarified, but the New Testament helps us to understand and clarify. And unfortunately, for example, in the case of Judaism, since I've criticized Christianity and Islam, let's criticize Judaism. Judaism doesn't have the New Testament. Now, that's a big handicap. Wow. Talk about a handicap trying to understand. If you have only the Old Testament, You've got a big problem understanding things. You know, understanding the Old Testament is just the reality. But the Old Testament and New Testament fit in so well. It's like a puzzle that you're putting together, and the pieces fit so well, they complement each other. You know, if you only have half the pieces, you know, you don't have the other pieces to the puzzle, you've got a real problem there. And that's what Judaism has to deal with. They have just a very good foundation, but then they don't have the structure. They just have the foundation. They haven't filled it in. So in Acts 7, Stephen is giving the history of Israel. Now, he's under a lot of pressure here, so this is his final sermon that he gives before he's martyred. Then the high priest said, are these things so? He's been accused of, in effect, blasphemy. And he said, brethren and fathers, listen. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran. You know, so Abraham was in Iraq, what is today Iraq. He was living in a place called Ur, which is near what we call today the Persian Gulf. That's where, so civilization, one of the early centers of civilization was Iraq, which is interesting. Because here we are in the 21st century, and we have the modern advanced nations like the United States and Britain, and we're very much involved in Iraq. You know, things have come full circle. But let's notice what the situation was in Iraq in those days. If you go back to Joshua 24, it was pretty tough in Iraq. You were, you know, between a rock and a hard place. Sorry. Okay, Joshua 24. Even Gideon groaned at that one. All right. But back in Iraq, you're across, back in Iraq, wow, poetry. You're across the river, you're across the Euphrates River, and you're in a pagan environment. You talk about worshiping God, they were worshiping idols. Joshua 24. Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and we're going to hear about Shechem again. This area, Shechem, is a very important center of God's people. It's in the area of Samaria, the area of the northern kingdom. It was a Levitical city in ancient times, inhabited by Levites and also descendants of Joseph. It was in the territory of the people of Joseph, the birthright people. And it was a major center of worship of God, but it was an area that was preceded the Israelites. It was already a city that was inhabited by Canaanitish peoples before the Israelites got there. Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, or Shechem, and there's a city there now called Nablus, which is New City, Neapolis. In Arabic, they don't pronounce the P, so they call it Nablus. It's like the word Naples in Italy. Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel for their heads, for their judges, for their officers, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, thus says the eternal God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. They dwelt on the other side of the Euphrates, and they were in a pagan environment. And God wanted them physically removed from there so they could start a new civilization based upon God's way of life, based upon the morality of the Bible, an ethical civilization, a monotheistic ethical civilization, ethical monotheism. And I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, and so he became known as a Hebrew, one who's crossed over the river. He became known in Ivri, and his ancestor had the name Eber, and he may have had that name before, or maybe they gave it to him because his descendants had crossed the river. Anyway, Abraham was a descendant of Eber, but he himself crossed the river Euphrates, and he became Abraham the Hebrew. And that crossing of the river symbolized leaving paganism behind and worshiping the true God, who has the name Yahweh among various names he uses, particularly though he stresses personal name Yahweh, but there's other names by which he's called. Then I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him throughout all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his descendants, and gave him Isaac. And of course, the history goes through from there, from Abraham to Isaac, and from there to Jacob, to Israel, and to Christ, you know, through David and all of that. So let's go back now to Acts 7. So he was in Haran. He was across the river. and he was in idolatry. And here's what God said to him, and he's quoting from Genesis, but here Stephen's giving the account in Acts. And said to him, get out of your country and from your relatives and come to a land that I will show you. So he had to step out on faith and follow God's lead. This is, of course, a lesson that we learned from Abraham, that Abraham was willing to follow God's lead, put behind him what he had known, and go God's way, which is what we do when we make that commitment to Christ. We put behind us our own ways of thinking and others around us, and we follow God's way in faith. Then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. So you see what happened? God said, get out of there. So he left Ur. Now, a teacher of mine did a lot of research and came up with the conclusion that when Abraham left Ur, he was actually being rescued from a calamity that was going to happen. Ur was about to be invaded, I believe, at that time. So by leaving Ur, he was accomplishing two things. He was, yes, leaving a place he needed to leave, culturally speaking, but he also was getting away from a problem. And that may be why his family accompanied him. He did have many of his family come with him. Now, maybe because God had appeared in such a way that he had influenced the whole family. Or maybe Abraham was convincing enough that the family believed Abraham when he said, God has told me to leave. Maybe they've said, all right, well, we'll go along. Or it may be that they began to have a relationship with God as well. It would seem that they did. And they also may have left because they saw the coming trouble. So he left with a whole group of people, including his father, Terah, who had been an idolater. They all moved across the Euphrates, heading for Canaan, but they didn't go there originally. They went first to where you would go if you left Iraq, to Syria. They first went to Syria. Verse 4. Then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. Oh, so he went first to Syria from Iraq. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell, the land of Israel. Remember that Stephen here is speaking in Jerusalem. And gave him no inheritance in it. Abraham was living in on the margins of society then. Not that he was poor. He was very wealthy, but he was in a kind of Bedouin-like lifestyle, which in those days was more typical of that region. So it's not like he was some kind of a you know, vagabond or hobo or something. He was living quite well, but in a temporary kind of environment, tentative kind of environment, like as a Bedouin. And God gave him no inheritance in it, not even enough to set his foot on. But even when Abraham had no child, he promised to give it to him for a possession and to his descendants after him. And of course, later on, he miraculously gave him a child, Isaac, as we've already read. All right, now with that background, now let's go to Genesis 12. And it really clarifies a lot of what you read in Genesis 12, if you have that background from Acts 7. All right, so I'm beginning actually in Genesis 11. In Genesis 11, at the end of the chapter, if you heard these groans and giggles, it's because I often do that. I go to a verse and then I go back a few verses. All right, so here we are in, here I am anyway, in Genesis 11, and we're talking about Terah, who was Abraham's father. And people were living, evidently some people anyway, were living longer then than they do now, although as time went on, lifespans began to decrease. You know, when you come to David, in the Bible, he was 70, and he was old at 70. And so you see that eventually lifespans became pretty much what they are now. And now they're kind of cycling back up again. And so we have people living now longer than they have been. But way back in Abraham's time, there were those who lived quite a long time. And as time went on, you know, you can see how the ages decrease. By the time you get to Joseph, he lives to be 110, which of course nowadays would be a lot, but it was a lot less than his ancestors, some of them anyway, had, you know, his immediate ancestors had lived. But now people are living almost that long, you know. People are living to be over 100 quite commonly. All right, anyway, let's go to Genesis 11. Now Terah lived 70 years and begot Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. He had three sons that are mentioned here. And so we have Avram, which means exalted father. So he seemed to have named him with perhaps some deity in mind, or perhaps that's for some hope of greatness for him. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot. Oh, okay. Haran was Abraham's brother. Lot was the son of Haran, which means that Lot was Abraham's nephew. So we have a little bit of background there, which, you know, comes up later. You've all heard of Lot. I'm not going to say a lot about Lot. today, but you know, you've all heard of him. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land in Ur of the Chaldees. So Haran evidently did not accompany them there or died before they left. So he died back there in Iraq. Then Abram and Nahor took wives. Okay, so all of this happened before they left, obviously, because they had to take wives first. Then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. Her name was originally Sarai, and then she became Sarah later. And the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and the father of Issachar. So we see the background of the families there. And Milcah is mentioned later because Milcah has Bethuel. Let's just jump ahead just in the genealogy to keep the family record here. Let's go to Genesis 22 for just a moment. At the end of Genesis 22, we see Milcah's mentioned, all right? Milcah is the daughter of Nahor. I'm sorry, Milcah is the wife of Nahor. So Nahor was Abraham's brother. Milcah is his sister-in-law. And Milcah has a daughter named, has a son named Bethuel. Okay, so here we have verse 20. Now it came to pass after these things, Genesis 22:20, that it was told Abraham, saying, indeed, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor. And it mentions various ones, and at the end it mentions Bethuel. All right? Huz, his firstborn, Buz, his brother, Kemuel, the father of Aram, Hesed, Hazo, Pildash, Jidlaf, and Bethuel. So a lot of children. But Bethuel is mentioned, and Bethuel begot Rebekah. So eight children Nahor had. Eight children that Milcah bore, where Sarah only had the one child, Isaac. Milcah had eight children, and one of them was Bethuel, and Bethuel was Rebekah's father. So Rebekah was, what does that make her? That makes her the cousin to Isaac, the second cousin, right, to Isaac, the second cousin. Everybody, I'm right? So a distant, in that sense, relative to Isaac, part of that same clan. And Isaac later on, as you know, marries Rebekah. So we have that background. Nobody's confused. If you were confused, go back to the verses and look at them at your leisure, and you can follow it. All right, let's go back now to this history, this family history here. And the sad story is in verse 30, that Sarai was barren. She had no child, but Sarai was barren. She had no child, but she miraculously bore a child when she was really too old to have one. God intervened in a miraculous way and gave her Isaac. Yitzchak, and of course Isaac was the son through whom the promise was passed, and so it was miraculous. And as God, and God does miraculous things to carry out His plan, and He deliberately does it miraculously because He's putting His stamp on it. This is a divine plan, and so things happen in this plan miraculously. Anyway, verse 31. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan. Oh, so as I said, how do we know the background? Well, because Stephen said God had appeared to Abraham, said go to Canaan. So they're starting to go to Canaan. Abraham and his family, somehow they were all part of it, you know. But they didn't get that far. They only got as far as Syria and stopped. You know, it doesn't say why, but they went to a certain point and stopped. They went to the land of Canaan, they came to Haran and dwelt there. Now maybe there were issues why they had to stop there. Maybe Haran felt, you know, maybe Terah felt he couldn't go any farther. There may have been, you know, for various reasons they just didn't go any farther at that point. So the days of Terah were 205 years. As I said, you know, people were living longer then, but the lifespans began to diminish. And by the time you get, as I said, to David's time, 70 years is considered old. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. But remember, God had said to Abraham, get out and go to Canaan. You know, go to the land I will show you. And we know that land was the land that was called Canaan, or it's sometimes called Palestine. It's the land of Israel. So here in Genesis 12, now we see the background. So we in effect have a flashback. But we know it's a flashback from Acts 7. Now the Eternal had said to Abram, so the translator here is being a little bit loose, but it's not necessarily wrong, but he's putting a spin on it because he understands Acts 7. Now the Eternal had said to Abram, or to Abram, Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house. You know, it sounds very dramatic in the Hebrew. Lech lecha me'artzitcha u'mimolatetcha u'mibeit avicha el ha'aretz asher areka. You know, it just sounds very, very powerful in the Hebrew. Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. So here God takes Abraham and tells him, I'm taking you away from this civilization. We're beginning in you a new civilization, and you're going to be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. So ultimately, those who oppose Abraham and oppose God's people will ultimately, you know, suffer for it. On the other hand, those who are blessing of Abraham, blessing of God's people, will ultimately benefit for it. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. There's a double meaning there. Abraham, of course, because he was going to be very prosperous, will bring prosperity to the world. But more importantly, through Abraham will come Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world. So through Abraham, all the world will be blessed, spiritually speaking. So there's a double blessing here, which in the old days we used to call race and grace, which isn't a bad way to put it. In other words, we have a blessing of a national importance, national prominence, national prosperity, but more importantly, grace, spiritual blessing, that from him comes the Messiah, which we talk, which is, of course, more is covered later about that. So Abram departed as the Eternal had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And so this is why he left, because he couldn't stay in Syria. He had to go farther. He was supposed to go into Canaan. That's where God wanted him to go. And so he went there finally after his father died. He waited for his father to die. Now, this is tomorrow's Mother's Day. We're supposed to respect our family. Abraham stayed there until his father died. Then he left. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. But he did live quite a bit after that. You know, as I said, some lifespans were longer in those days. Then Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all the possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran. So they had developed a community. They had evidently purchased servants, and perhaps they had some kind of following, even from a spiritual point of view. You know, the Jews believed that these souls they had acquired in Haran, you know, the literal word is I think, nefesh in the Hebrew, the souls that they had acquired in Haran, you know, that this is talking about people who were converted to the worship of the true God and were part of Abraham's community in terms of his religious community. So they took all those people with them and went down to Canaan, whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. So now Abraham comes to the promised land. He comes to the promised land, and there's some interesting context here to look into. Abram passed through the land to the place of, again, Shechem. See that same place I read about earlier? See that it has an importance historically. Way back in Abraham's time, there it is, and he goes there. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, or Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh, or the oak tree. And the tree of Moreh, maybe some of you know enough Hebrew that Moreh is a teacher. So this is like the teacher's tree. So perhaps this was a landmark where people would gather for instruction. Perhaps this became a place where people would gather and be taught. And maybe that's how it got this name, the Terebinth Tree of Moreh, you know, the teaching tree. And the Canaanites were then in the land. So this is what the situation. Abram was going into a land that he would someday inherit. Actually, his descendants would inherit. He was a stranger and a pilgrim there. He was, in effect, in a minority, in a religious and ethnic minority. Then the Eternal appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." And there he built an altar to the Eternal that appeared to him. And he moved from there to the mountain. Now let's stop here a moment. Something was pointed out to me decades ago by a very wonderful teacher, Dr. David Wainwright, and I have heard that he is not in the best of health, and so I would appreciate that you would pray for him. Many of you have been taught, I'm sure, over the years by Dr. David Wainwright, a very wonderful man. And one thing he pointed out about when Abram went down to the Promised Land, He went to a city called Shechem, which is in a valley, and therefore it's an important location. It was an important commercial center, and later on, as you know, a religious and cultural center. But just to the north east of there is the Mount Ebal, and to the southwest is Mount Gerizim, those two mountains. And Ebal is about 3,000 feet high, which, you know, I suppose to somebody from Colorado, that's like a pimple, you know. But in the land of Israel, that's a high place. That's a mountain. 3,000 feet is high there. So it's the highest point in anywhere around there. And very likely Abraham could go up to Mount Ebal and look over the land. And when God said, I will give you this land, he might have been up at Mount Ebal looking over the whole area. And I think what David Wainwright said is that if you're up on Mount Ebal, you can see at least a little bit of each of the tribal territories from that spot, from that 3,000-foot high spot. You can see almost at least a little piece of what every tribe was going to inherit later of the 12 tribes of Israel. So I thought that was very interesting. And so these are little things you get when you focus more on what's here. So he built an altar there, and he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and of course mountain more of a hill. And he pitched his tent with Bethel, what we would call a hill. And he pitched his tent with Bethel on the east and Ai on the Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Eternal and called on the name of the Eternal. So we see that he was worshiping Yahweh, the God of the Bible. Now, I don't know why Cecil B. DeMille made such a big deal about this concept of the God who has no name. You see that God is using his name all through the book of Genesis, unless Moses is writing anachronistically. But I think that the point in Exodus 6, is that now he was going to fulfill the meaning of the name. Not that they really didn't know the name, but now he was going to actually fulfill the meaning of the name. In Exodus 6, I believe, is where the problem comes from, why Cecil B. DeMille did what he did. But the way the Jews take this, because they can read Genesis, and they can read Yahweh all through Genesis. So in Genesis 6, then the Eternal said to Moses, I'm in Exodus 6. Let's jump to Exodus 6 if you care to. I realize some of you are listening to this while you're driving, so don't get into a wreck or anything. You know, it's bad enough. Something happened recently. There was a terrible thing. Somebody was texting, and he was trying to drive a train while texting. You know, that's not the thing to do. This happened. Where did this happen? Up in the Bay Area? Up in the Bay Area, I think, right?
SoCal?
Oh, boy. Anyway, they don't need any more trouble there. Anyway, then the Eternal said to Moses, I want to take a detour for just a moment. One of my great experiences in life has been driving up the Pacific Coast Highway, Highway 101. And it really reminds one of the land of Israel. The topography is very similar. It's really interesting. I could do a Bible flick and film it there, and you'd think it was in the land of Israel. In fact, it probably has been done many times. But I remember one slide I used to use of a flock of sheep somewhere near Fresno. And you could just as easily assume it was a Bible, biblically oriented slide. Well, I used to use it in a Passover slideshow. But anyway, the point I'm bringing out is that highway is inch for inch one of the most beautiful places in the world, I think. Not that I haven't seen every place in the world. I've seen more than most. But it's really a beautiful place. But one of the most beautiful cities that I've ever been in is Santa Barbara. And, I hope you'll pray for Santa Barbara now. They've got a very severe fire situation there. And so I appreciate your prayers for Santa Barbara. Anyway, to get back to Exodus 6, then the Eternal said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. You know, so God is going to be so dramatic in what he does that Pharaoh is going to throw you out. Instead of resisting it as he has been, he's going to throw you out of there. And God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am Yahweh. You know, now he said, I appeared to Isaac, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. So he did have a name he used, El Shaddai. That was the name he used, El Shaddai, which you can look up, find it in Genesis 17, for example, as God Almighty. But by my name Yahweh, I was not known to them. I was not known to them. The point of this is not that they didn't know the word. The point is that he didn't fulfill the meaning of the name. The name Yahweh indicates God who is involved in human affairs, God who makes promises and keeps them. And he did not entirely fulfill that until he delivered them from Egypt, brought them to Sinai, made of them a nation, you know, confirmed his covenant with them. So he fulfilled the meaning of the name Yahweh at that time. So it doesn't necessarily mean they didn't use the name. Because if you go through Genesis, you'll see the name several times. So that's my spin on it, and also the traditional Jewish spin on it. And then there's also the Hollywood spin on it, so you can take your choice, I guess. All right, Genesis 12. So one of the interesting principles of the Bible, let's put it this way. One of the interesting principles that students of the Bible have come up with, the Bible doesn't exactly say it this way, but the rabbis have said that Maase Avod Siman Levanim, that the actions of the fathers are a sign to their offspring. So what happens to Abraham happens to his descendants in a way. It's interesting. He goes through experiences that the whole nation goes through. He is the father of the nation, goes through experiences that later on the whole nation experience, so that the deeds of the fathers become a sign to their offspring. It's quite interesting. And here we have an example of that. Let's go to Genesis 15. Here Abraham is given a prophecy, you know, that his people would be strangers for quite some time. It would be quite a while till they actually inherited the land. 4 centuries would go by. Now that's another problem with the Ten Commandment movie that a lot of you have seen, that I have memorized. I've seen it so often, that they were not in Egypt for 400 years, but they were a minority for 400 years, but they, some of that time they were in Canaan, some of that time they were in Egypt, but they were not in Egypt for 400 years, again, as would be the Hollywood view. But anyway, they were, however, an oppressed minority, generally speaking, for 400 years. If you go to Genesis 15:13, then he said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land." By the way, we all understand that this name went from Abram to Avraham. It went from Abram, from Abram to Abraham. That you find in Genesis 17. God had his original name was Aleph Bet Resh Mem, Avram's name. Aleph Bet Resh Mem. God took that name and added the 5th letter of the Hebrew alphabet to it. And God, when he shows his love, does it in multiples of 5. That's just one way God operates in the Bible. That there's a numerical significance. There's numerical patterns in the Bible, and God shows his mercy, his love, in multiples of 5. And so he takes the 5th letter of the Hebrew alphabet and adds it to Abraham's name, and that 5th letter, Hey, stands for Hamon Goyim, a multitude of nations. And so he calls him Avraham. And so now he becomes Avraham because he's going to be the father of many nations. And then Sarai takes the name Sarah, meaning princess, because she becomes the princess. She becomes the great mother of Israel, and also in that sense of Jesus Christ. She becomes our mother as Abraham becomes our father. So she takes the name Sarah, or princess. God says to Abraham, call your wife Sarah. This is in Genesis 17. But at this point, he's still Avram, and she's still Sarai. So in Genesis 15, then he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge afterward, and I will judge. Afterward, they shall come out with great wealth. So the Israelites left Egypt finally with great wealth. Now that is something, again, you will see in the Ten Commandment movie that is well done, where they show how the Israelites are leaving with spoils of Egypt. You know, they show that very graphically in the film. So this was what happened. God said they're going to be servants in Egypt, and they're going to leave with great wealth. Well, you know what? Abraham had had that same experience himself. Which is, it's interesting, but he had that same experience personally. So let's go back to Genesis 12. You know, I may never get out of Genesis 12. I thought this talk was going to cover 3 chapters. I'm not sure it will. Anyway, in Genesis 12, And it came to pass, I'm sorry, let's go back to the verse, where shall we be? We should be in Genesis 12. I'll go back to verse 8 so you can get back to the story. Abraham is now around the middle of the country, around the middle of what is today Israel. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Eternal and called on the name of the Eternal. Now let's remember our Bible. There was one central sanctuary eventually. God allowed at this time in history, when his people were Bedouins, to, you know, in effect, to, you know, have certain places that they designated as places of worship where they would build an altar. Eventually, the only focus of that kind of activity is the Temple Mount itself. There's one holy temple in Jerusalem, and there aren't supposed to be competing altars elsewhere, ever, you know, in this age anyway, you know. So that's a comment I wanted to make. There's only one central sanctuary, and it's the temple. Right now it's not functioning, but that doesn't matter. We don't need it. Christians don't need it to be functioning, as you understand. And if you don't, keep listening, and we'll explain that. Anyway, not today, but, you know, down the line. Genesis 12:9. So Abram journeyed going on still toward the south, or towards what we call the Negev. You know, going to the Negev, which is a drier area. It might not have been quite as dry then as it is now. Now it's quite a desert. There's one important city there that Abraham was, I think, established, if you keep reading, and that's Beersheba or Beersheba. But that's the capital of the Negev. But here he goes to the Negev. So Abram journeyed going on still toward the south. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. So he's, in effect, pushed to go to Egypt, and he's tested there, and, you know, maybe his conduct was less than what it should have been, although God blessed him and got him out of there. Verse 11, it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he pulled a stunt which is not where he was not necessarily dishonest, but he was being tricky, you might say, evasive, gray, what you might call a gray area. In these ancient times, some marriages were entered into that were later on prohibited. They were incestuous. But in early years, some of these incestuous relationships were evidently were permitted. But as time went on, they finally came to be prohibited. And Leviticus 18 gives a table of prohibited relationships. The United States government goes even a bit farther and prohibits first cousins from marrying, which the Bible, as far as I know, did not prohibit, but now the government prohibits. So even as later times go on, even relations like first cousin evidently are now dangerous. I don't know the genetic reason why, but anyway, there are incestuous relationships that are prohibited, and Leviticus 18 has them. But back then, Abraham married a half-sister. Not a sister, but a half-sister. In fact, he explains that in Genesis 21. In Genesis 20, because he pulls the stunt again later. You'd think he after pulling it once, he wouldn't pull it again. But he pulled the stunt twice. But let's go to Genesis 20 and verse 12. Now, this is a second episode of where he does a similar thing. But indeed, she is truly my sister. This is what Abraham says about Sarah. This is Genesis 20:12. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. So she was his half-sister, was his wife. So he figured he was not really lying. Anyway, Genesis 12:11. And it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to Sarai his wife, indeed I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. And yet by now they were already quite old, and yet she was still quite beautiful. So she must have really been something special to be as old as she was and still very beautiful. And now there are women today, you know, who you see them at least from a distance, you see them on film or TV, and they're, you know, getting on in years and still quite attractive. And Sarai was in that category. Verse 12, therefore it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. So he was afraid that would happen. So he says, say you're my sister. So I guess he's thinking, well, that way they'll you know, kind of be interested in her, but maybe I can be in and out of there before anything happens. I mean, at least they won't kill me. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. But you see, the problem was that this trickery got him into trouble. Because once she said that she was his sister, they believed it, and they acted a little more hastily than he thought they would. They got more zealous than he thought they would, I guess. So it was when Abram... please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. So it was when Abram came into Egypt that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. Now we should be very grateful that we do live in the United States. And I fear for the future of this country in terms of the liberties that we have taken for granted. I'm afraid they might be slipping away. But in old days, kings had tremendous power over people, and they had, you know, prerogatives. Like if you remember the story of Esther, how Xerxes in Persia was able to say, gather all the beautiful, you know, gather all the young virgins together, and, you know, I want to choose a new queen. And, you know, they were able to just grab women, you know, and take them, and he makes his choice, you know. And that's the kind of power that these monarchs had in those days. You know, a very frightful thing to think about, the status of women in those cultures. So, you know, here they see that Sarah's beautiful, so they say, oh, she's so beautiful, Pharaoh ought to have her, you know. So it was when Abram came into Egypt that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. The princes of Egypt also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. Now, Abraham, you know, I guess at this point, what's he going to do? You know, you might not agree and with what he did do, which was evidently not much. You know, she was taken. He didn't protest. He didn't say anything. You know, of course, he felt if he did, that they would just do away with him. But that's not the case. What's interesting is that the Pharaoh had more of a conscience than Abraham gave him credit for. Verse 16. Meantime, though, because he took his sister, you know, he gave him all of this wealth. So I guess that was quite a temptation too to Abraham, you know, to have all this wealth. And maybe it was a temptation to Sarah to become, you know, to get into Pharaoh's palace. I mean, we don't know what was going on. The account is quite terse. He treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. So he became quite a rich man over this. But the Eternal plagued Pharaoh in his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So this is a part of the Bible a lot of people don't know about. So in ancient times, the palace of Pharaoh was plagued supernaturally, just as the nation as a whole was plagued later. You know, when Abraham's descendants, who had grown to a huge nation, were now in Egypt centuries later, they were enslaved, and as Sarah was enslaved. Sarah, as our mother, is a type of the nation. God pictures his people as a female. And here this female, the church or the nation of Israel, was in bondage. And so the offending party, the Pharaoh and his household, were being plagued. It was like a preview of what would happen at the time of the Exodus. But the Eternal plagued Pharaoh in his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now, therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way. Evidently, it never got that far. She was evidently being, you know, prepared, groomed, whatever, you know, as maybe Esther was. If you look at the book of Esther, all the different things they did to women before they were ready, you know, ready to go to the king. They would bathe them in this and fix them with that and, you know, trim them with this, whatever, their hair, whatever, their nails, whatever they did, you know. So she was getting, I guess, all of her beauty treatments or whatever, and she hadn't yet gone to him. Or maybe he just hadn't gotten around to her. You know, he had a harem, hadn't gotten around to it. But in any case, he never did anything, and he said, I might have and I shouldn't have. It's wrong, you know. So I'll get to that in a moment, a little bit more about that. Why did you say she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now, therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way. In other words, because he was plagued on account of him, he didn't want him around. Plus, he was probably a little bit disappointed with how he had acted. So just leave. But take, you can take all that I gave you, though, which is interesting. I guess he felt like Abraham was obviously a person whom God was supernaturally protecting. So he felt like he spooked him out, you know. He was afraid of him in a way. So get out of here, but I'm not going to hurt you, but I want you out of here because, in effect, I'm afraid. But you can keep all this wealth because maybe if, you know, I do this, your God will bless me. That's possibly what he was thinking. And, you know, Pharaoh said the same thing to Moses. When Moses left, he said, you know, bless me on your way out, you know, because he was afraid of what of Moses' God by that time. Anyway, verse 20. So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. So he left Egypt. His wife had been incarcerated, a slave in effect. And then now she's liberated. He's liberated. They leave, and they leave with great wealth as a preview of what would happen to their descendants. It's quite interesting. They leave Egypt, and they go back to the promised land. Now, it's interesting that in the promised land, he has an episode later on, and I'm skipping all of chapter 13 and most of 14 to get to this episode. But it's in the spring of the year, it's the time of the Passover. You can figure that out from the context. And he comes to a time when he meets in verse 18 of Genesis 14 a Canaanite king who was also a priest who worshipped the God that Abraham worshipped. And he considered him the most high God. Because this was a time when people had gods and goddesses aplenty. But he knew there was one God who was the most high God. That's the God that he worshipped, and that's the God that Abraham worshipped. He worshipped, you know, Elyon, the most high God. And he was called Melchizedek, which means priest of righteousness. And he was also the king of Salem, which means peace. But it was the name of that area, Jerusalem, which, as I've already mentioned, became the central sanctuary for God's people. Then Melchizedek, which is going to be eventually the capital of the world. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of the Most High God. So here is a person who's called king of righteousness, who's king of Salem, and he's a priest of the Most High God. He's a king and he's a priest, and he brings out bread and wine to Abraham during the spring of the year. Now, I can't guarantee it was the spring of the year, but it probably was. But in any case, he brings out bread and wine to Abraham. So, you know, when you read this, what do you think about? You think about Jesus Christ. You think about the Passover. You almost can't help it if you know the New Testament. And indeed, the New Testament elaborates on this. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him a tithe of all. Abraham tithed to this righteous man, to this priest and king. Abraham actually tithed to him, setting an example for Christians to be tithe payers. Abraham was the father of the faithful. He tithed to this king and priest who was serving the Most High God, who had a ministry at that time. And he tithed to that ministry. Now, Psalm 110 tells us that this priest is the model for the Messiah, who was not a Levite, not a Kohen, not a descendant of Aaron, but yet who'll be a Melchizedek type of priest. A priest not because of his lineage, but because of his perfection, because of his righteousness, because he was a king. He was from the line of David and therefore qualified to be king. But he also was a priest, a Melchizedek priest, a priest because of his perfect righteousness. So here we have in Psalm 110 a messianic prophecy, which shows that the Messiah would be both a descendant of David, but also would be divine, a perfect being, and a priest forever. And now we go to Hebrews 7. And so we see how, when you go back to the Old Testament, you see how events in the Old Testament foreshadow future events, and you see how concepts in the Old Testament are elaborated upon and developed in the New. And so the Bible fits together in that way. And so when you read the life of Abraham, the father of the faithful, there's so many lessons that apply to Christians, and there's so many concepts that are developed, as I said, more fully in the New Testament, and it all ties together. So I wanted to conclude this discussion by going to Hebrews 7. Just as Abraham was met by Melchizedek, this righteous priest and king of that time, and tied to him, let's go to Hebrews 7. In that account in Genesis, there's no genealogy given for Melchizedek. He's not born, he doesn't die, he just appears. You know, he's just there, and he does what he does his thing, and then you don't hear about him again. And so he's a type of Jesus Christ who literally is immortal, who literally does have no genealogy because he's immortal. You know, he's eternal. He's God in the flesh. So he has a genealogy as Davidic, but from a divine point of view, of course, he's eternal. He's the Logos, the Word of God. So in in Hebrews 7 and verse 24, talking about this Melchizedek, because he continues forever, he has an unchangeable priesthood. Therefore, he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. So when we read in Genesis about Abraham and Melchizedek, we can project that, and we can think about us as the children of Abraham, spiritually speaking, coming to Melchizedek in the person of Jesus Christ, coming to our high priest and king and savior, and having that relationship with God through Christ. Now, I'd like to add one last thought, one last point to this discussion. A few days ago, should have been Thursday, should have been on Thursday, and I just, when I make these comments, I often like to check myself to make sure. Actually, it would have been Friday. Friday was the 14th day of the second month. Friday was the 14th day of the second month. Now, that would be a second Passover. You may remember that in ancient times, if people were unclean, you know, spiritually speaking, you know, ritually speaking, and they couldn't sacrifice the lamb and eat the lamb, they actually were given a time to do it a month later. They could wait for the 14th day of the second month, which would have been yesterday, and they could have killed the lamb then, and they would have been eating it last night. You know, they would have been keeping the Sabbath as well as having the lamb as part of their Sabbath dinner, but they also would be eating the Passover lamb as well. And they could have done it that way. They could have sacrificed the Passover Friday and eaten it last night if they had missed it the first time. Now, there's a lesson in that it just hit me today. It didn't hit me. I read it. But, I mean, I read it in a Jewish commentary. But it was, I was telling my wife a couple of things today, and I was laughing out loud because, for example, I was talking about Shechem before, and the two mountains that were there, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And how many times I've read about Shechem and about Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. You may remember the Israelites went to Shechem, and some tribes lined up on one mountain, and some tribes lined up on the other mountain, and prophecies were given about blessings and cursings. And the skeleton kind of mountain, the bear mountain, I mean B-A-R-E, you know, that, and not bear mountain, with B-E-A-R, but the bear mountain was Mount Ebal. And then the blessed mountain, the green mountain, was Mount Gerizim. And that was the mountain of blessing, and Ebal was the mountain of cursing. Well, Gerizim is south of Ebal. And you know, in the Middle East, you face east, and therefore south is on your right. And as you know, in the Bible, culturally speaking, usually you think of the right as prominent over the left. That's sort of culturally how the Bible works. And even today, we kind of have that concept. Because most people are right-handed, we think of the right as being, you know, we even say, you're right. And we use the term right for your right hand as also meaning correct. The right way is the correct way. So it's just culturally something. So it's interesting that in the Bible, the Mount of Blessing was naturally, culturally speaking, would be the mountain on the right, and you know, which would have been to the south, looking eastward. So the Mountain of Blessing was on the right, Mountain of Cursing was on the left, and it's just an interesting point. But it's taken me, you know, six decades to figure that out. You know, but I guess better late than never. You know, just a little point that when you look eastward, the Mountain of Blessing is on the right; it's to the south. You know, which is just a little thing, but. You know, it's something I should have known when I was about five. And then another thing I learned today was the significance of the second Passover. Why do we have a second Passover? Well, it's because, you know, what if you don't come to Jesus Christ in a timely fashion? I mean, what is the Passover about? It's about repentance and accepting the sacrifice of Christ. It's about forgiveness for sin and committing yourself to being righteous. Well, that's something that if you don't do earlier, you can do later. You know, just like God, as God says, okay, a month later you can do it. It's the same thing. At some point, you come to relationship with God through Jesus Christ. If you don't do it in a timely fashion, then you do it later, but you do it. And God allows you to do it later. And in another sense, If you look at the whole system of holy days, it teaches us that God has a plan whereby some people who are like the first fruits, not like, but they're compared to the first fruits, the forerunners, the vanguard, the pioneers, they're brought into the system earlier, and then others are brought in later. So just as there's a first and second Passover, you know, there are those who are brought in now and those who are brought in later, which is the message all through the holy days. So again, you know, the Old Testament in Numbers 9, the second Passover, ties in with the message of the New Testament in a very wonderful way. So let me finish again by reading what Abraham learned and what we can learn from that passage as explained by Hebrews. In Hebrews 7 and verse 24, this Melchizedek, whom Abraham knew, is a type of Jesus Christ, whom Abraham also knew, because Abraham did know Christ, you know, and he was a person converted who will be in the millennium with Christ. We have that promise. Abraham will be there. We hope we can be there too. Hebrews 7:24. But he, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Verse 25. Therefore, he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Even though I finish with Hebrews, but these are some lessons that we can learn from Genesis. Well, I thank you for listening. Remember, Pentecost is coming up, so make your plans accordingly for that. And in the meantime, you know, we have this secular holiday, which I think is a wonderful holiday based on Scripture of honoring our mothers, and later on we'll honor our fathers. So happy Mother's Day again, and wonderful Sabbath to everybody. And we're certainly looking forward also to the upcoming Pentecost festival. In the meantime, all the best to you and yours.